Learn more about the albums you love with Dissect, a music analysis podcast hosted by me, Cole Kushner, a lifelong musician. Each season of Dissect dives deep into one album, examining the music, lyrics, and meaning of one song per episode. We've covered albums by Kendrick Lamar, Tyler, the Creator, Frank Ocean, just to name a few, and our brand new season just launched all about Radiohead's 2007 masterpiece, In Rainbows. Listen to Dissect on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, because great art deserves more than a swipe.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio, if you can avoid time slipping, it's Andy Greenwald!
Sometimes I feel in my body like time slipping looked.
Yeah, it doesn't look pleasant for Loki, who is back in season two of his titular series, or he is the titular star of the series.
Say it three times and the spirit titular shows up. You don't want to see that.
Yeah. It's great to see you. It's great to see Kaya. It's kind of Marvel week on The Watch, because we're going to talk a little bit about the first episode of the second season of Loki today. And then on Thursday's show, mm-hmm. we are joined by Joanna Robinson from the House of R. Mm-hmm.
This is great.
He's got a new book about Marvel coming out, and we're going to talk to her all about like kind of like a more broad state of the MCU.
Do you know what this is called when a podcast pivots to covering the most popular thing in pop culture? It's called a zig.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. So like we'll move off of 1980s English gold heists and into Marvel?
We're zigging. We're going full mainstream core this week.
Joanna's book is called MCU, The Reign of Marvel Studios. It's out October 10th, which, if my math is correct, is tomorrow.
Your math is correct, sir.
Andy, how are you doing? I had a lovely weekend in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. Shout out to the Pacific Northwest. Want to hear some anecdotes, or do you want to
I 100% want to hear anecdotes. Obviously, we'll talk about the gold. We'll talk about Loki. We'll talk about Chris's overuse of the word titular. But let's talk about putting birds on stuff. Let's do it.
So I have two things I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
One is Portland oriented, and the other mm-hmm. is pop culture oriented.
Uh-huh.
On Friday, it was my wife, Phoebe's birthday, and I say happy birthday to her publicly now.
I did as well. I sent her a text.
Did you?
Of course I did.
She didn't mention it.
It seemed like it meant a lot to her at the time.
Amazing.
On Friday, we went to go to dinner. That was lovely. Mm-hmm.
Do you get the, did you have them like bring out a cake and sing to you?
They brought out a fruit crisp.
I guess they don't all sing anymore. That's
they
like
brought out a fruit crisp, and they brought out a candle that was in a rooster like candle mold, which I thought was pretty cool. I don't know why, but there was we didn't even have any chicken, but it wasn't
like a small bird you could crunch like an ortolan. It wasn't like
it wasn't like that.
Okay,
and then we went to go do karaoke.
This I was interested in.
This is one of those karaoke places where they got everything.
And this wasn't just the two of you, right? You went out with some local pals.
We went out with some other friends up there. So there was 8 of us.
Did they ask about me?
Broadly speaking, yeah. Like in terms of my professional happiness.
How's the podcast that you do with the other guy?
Yeah. And they were like, I was like,
it's fine.
And I got to tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to write songs about the songs that I sang at karaoke.
Really?
Are you a karaoke guy?
No.
Do you like participating in it?
No.
Do you like watching it, like being in it in the room while other people are singing?
I'm out on fun. No.
Have you ever done it with me?
No. So this is why I'm interested. And I'll confess my own karaoke thing in a moment. This is your time to grab the mic.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say that I am a benevolent god when it comes to karaoke, because I don't think about, you know, am I going to blow people away with my pitch, mm-hmm. with my undiscovered singing talent? It's mm-hmm. not about that. Mm-mm. It's about finding the song, finding the moment, mm-hmm. and bringing people together.
That's beautiful.
So it's kind of bringing that DIY aesthetic mm-hmm. to karaoke through song selection and performance style. And then I just went on this run, dude.
And community uplift, which is the third pillar of the hardcore aesthetic that you, right?
Yes. Yes.
It is true.
So I had an amazing run of Dancing with Myself, Robin.
Slash the Phillies.
And
yes.
Dancing on My Own, Billy Idol.
Whoa.
And I also did a little Boys of Summer, Don Henley, which feels very maudlin.
Yeah.
But among a group of middle-aged people is quite fun.
It's a little slow now. Is that all right?
And then, you know, because you start to get self-conscious when you're singing, you're doing karaoke, because you're like, oh, I hold these truths to be self-evident, mm-hmm. that this song is awesome and that everybody loves it. But what if everybody's like, what is this one?
Oof.
You know?
Right.
And for some reason, I got a little shaky about This Must Be the Place by Talking Heads.
It's in the zeitgeist again.
And it is in the zeitgeist again, but sometimes I feel like you and I are a little too zeited out, you know? We're geisted up.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, these people, they've got 2-3 kids, they've got, you know, like their own...
The David Byrne vocal, that's a different range.
No, it's okay.
Is it?
Because there's a lot of gang vocals on that.
Oh, okay.
So you can just do kind of like, everybody sings along on the chorus. It's a lot of fun.
Do you swing your mic like Adam Lazar of Taking Back Sunday and then get the crowd involved?
No, but I did Dance with a Lamp.
Wow.
Is there
footage of this?
No.
Did everyone have to put their phones in those little bags when they entered because of...
Yes.
What I'm impressed by in this, and I'd love to hear Kaya's thoughts on this as well. I think genuinely that I could have a good time doing karaoke. The problem is because I spend 0% of my life thinking about it or preparing for it, I don't have something in my pocket when I walk into that booth. I think I need to have a song that I know...
I can take it down.
Like, the last time there was large-scale karaoke in my life was the Briar Patch rap party for season one. Mm. And
but you're in a position of sort of like people look at you, they're like, oh, the principal.
Well, that's why I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I was like, they have to respect me for Checks Watch 7 more days.
Yeah.
But TV's beloved J.R. Ferguson, for example, Jay, like, he's just having some fun. He's drinking beers all night. And then when they turn to him, he does the aw shucks. And then just walks to the stage with Johnny Cash in his back pocket Walk the Line. Everyone's like, what a hero.
Right.
He's prepared
right.
in the moment. I am not prepared. I should be. Kaya, do you have a song? Are you always ready?
Yeah. So I've done karaoke actually like quite a lot this year.
Kaya's had an incredible year. We should probably just preface it by saying.
Kaya possibly has had no bad days in 2023.
I had a karaoke birthday party. And
you did?
I did.
Oh, sick invite.
She got my RSVP. She got my regrets.
That is awesome.
And I also...
NFI, not fucking invited.
Now she's hearing that you're a value add. I think
next
she thought...
Time, next
yeah,
year.
I, well, this is... I have a point to make of it.
I want to hear.
And then I also, when I went to Stockholm with some of the Ringer crew,
there was
we did some karaoke.
I did not do it there.
And you know what hits at karaoke is Shallow.
Whoa.
By Lady Gaga.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is my thing. I never would have even thought of
Lady Gaga with Bradley Cooper.
Because to me, that's a ballad. To me, that requires a lot of good singing. Hmm. You find out very quickly when you're doing karaoke where your pitch is.
Right.
And my pitch is not the late Brian Johnson from AC/DC anymore, which I used to be able to do.
See, mine is more beleaguered Eagles offensive coordinator Brian Johnson.
He's not beleaguered
anymore. It was just a bit.
But this is a great example because if I were to go to say hang out, like Kaya invited me to do something.
It's possible.
And like Kaya was like, hey, all my cool friends.
All my best and coolest
this
friends.
This is this guy, Chris.
Who is our peer. And Chris shows up like Steve Buscemi in 30 Rock with a skateboard over his shoulder. Uh-huh.
And I was like, do you guys want to rock out to Don Henley's Boys of Summer or...
Here's
or
the thing.
The Talking Heads, This Must Be the Place. I bet we would find common ground on, say, Robin Dancing on My Own.
The reason I'm pushing back is because I feel like this would be your entree to the group, even if it wasn't a karaoke party.
Yes.
If you're like, what's up, guys? You want to talk about Don Henley?
Or Lioness. Which one?
Yeah,
there's only two options.
So, okay.
But here's my thing. you know, you make assumptions about your taste. You mm-hmm. make assumptions about what you like mattering to other people. It's, and Andy.
Yeah, that was our 20s.
Do you know what happened? I think Universal Studios made those same assumptions about The Exorcist.
Whoa. This whole thing was an intro? Do you see this, Kaya? You should invite him. Look how great he is at conversations.
So last week, I went on The Big Picture with Sean Fennessy.
Is that a podcast?
And we talked about The Exorcist colon Believer, and we also talked about the horror movies of 2023. And if you're interested in such scares and thrills, I recommend you check that out. Mm-hmm. But something really interesting happened this weekend, which is that Exorcist, for the most part, flopped. I mean, it did, I think it did about like, you know, maybe 31 million. And, but it felt like it was like DOA. It was like, right. it was not going to be something that like had legs because the reviews have been, well, I'll just recount a Scott Tobias tweet about the Exorcist reviews, which was when those Exorcist reviews drop and it was a body falling out of a coffin.
Jesus Christ.
So that's kind of where we're at with that. And Sean and I were like, there was some cool stuff about it, but we had like a lot of negative things to say about it. My point is that, so Universal spent $400 million on the sort of franchise rights to The Exorcist.
To get The Exorcist back.
Yeah. Now, I think Deadline did a really good box office write-up where they sort of broke this down. But essentially, like you would think, oh, $400 million, does that mean each one of these movies costs $133 million? It's not exactly like that. In fact, this first Exorcist film was $30 million, I think, to make, you know, in budget. But it was actually, a lot of the $400 million is talent buyouts, and it's like franchise rights for theme park stuff, and there's all of these different things involved.
Because the money that you're talking about was not to make this movie, right? It was to secure the rights?
Yeah, so here, this is the sort of most relevant paragraph from the Deadline article, which is, as we previously mentioned, this $400 million purchase by Universal for The Exorcist wasn't a scenario where the three movies would be produced for $133 million apiece. Some rival executives are under the impression that that's what the deal called for. The Exorcist deal was a broader franchise driver for Universal, which included production budgets, a buyout of talent and rights backends, producer fees, rights to leverage IP across the portfolio, and also to drive viewership on Peacock. Exorcist Believer has a 45-day theatrical window before landing on Peacock. And David Gordon Green, who directed The Exorcist, directed the Halloween movies. The last two Halloween movies were Day and Date on Peacock. So I think that they were in the theater, but you could also watch them on Peacock.
We also love him forever because of Eastbound and Down and
Gemstones. And, yes. I thought that this was really fascinating, but because they wrote a $400 million check for something that maybe nobody's interested in. And mm-hmm. I have been kind of fascinated by the way in which we've arrived at this point with franchises and with long-form storytelling and the idea of everything having a base or a foundation from which to build massive amounts of IP out of it. Mm-hmm. You see with the purchase of the Lord of the Rings TV rights by Amazon, the movie rights by Warner Brothers, the, you know, going back into the Harry Potter well by Warner Brothers. There's all this stuff going on. We've talked so much about Star Wars. We're going to talk about Marvel a lot this week. But it sounds like they basically paid $500 million to do something where they didn't have a story. To say nothing of the fact that they didn't necessarily have a story that really needed multiple movies.
Right.
And you know, when you see the amount of cuts and cancellations and layoffs that are happening in this business, do you think that there's a correlation between like the sort of reckless spending on this stuff because you have to get the name Exorcist or the name this to start building something out of it? And then you find yourself so far in the red just as the production has started, right. Just as this like project has started.
I think there's two issues at the root of what you're asking. One is investing in old stuff relevant? Mm-hmm. And that's the conversation we had about the Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah.
It's the conversation that we had with the people at Spotify when we requested additional years for our contracts and doing this podcast. Like, is there still, do the old guys still have anything to say? I think that that is a serious, I think it's a serious question and one worth exploring. I think people know from our multiple conversations around this topic how I feel about it. That like, just because it exists doesn't necessarily mean that we need more of it. It doesn't mean it's good. And increasingly, it doesn't even mean that it's a safe economic play. I think the other, to me, that what the story you're telling is connected to the story that's been coming out in the trade since the end of the writer's strike.
Yeah.
which is, you know, suddenly deals being slashed, shows that are either shot or mostly shot just being trashed. This speaks to me to a culture of fear and that people don't really know A, what they're doing, or B, what people want, which seems to be fundamentally the job of studios and development executives. And the bill is coming due for extremely expensive mistakes and misfires. And I think that, again, like when you buy the Exorcist IP in a climate of we need to fill these hours, we need to build our streaming brands, we need to flood the zone with identifiable stuff, you get DOA projects like The Exorcist, like the Frasier reboot, which is getting ripped in its reviews today. I haven't seen it yet.
Did you like Frasier the first time around?
Yeah.
Okay.
I love witty farces. That's on brand for me, don't you think? But if look, for me, no Niles, no life. Like I don't see what the show, frankly, I don't see what the show is without him. But then you also see these things that, and there's going to be more in the weeks to come, you know, potentially shocking ones about like, no, we've changed our mind, or the new economic climate, or the concessions we made in this deal with the writers and presumably in the deal that will come soon with the actors makes this no longer economically viable. And frankly, that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
These were mistakes before and they're mistakes now, and there are scapegoats every time. But the deeper issue is nobody knows what to do and nobody knows what people want. And for a brief time, franchises seemed like the safest hedge against that uncertainty. And I don't know if that continues to be the case. Whether it's a relatively august but aging, graying franchise like The Exorcist, or it's the MCU. We don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a ton of evidence. The Exorcist has a lot of name recognition. You know, I mean, have you seen the original Exorcist?
I have.
You have.
It's but a like, rare horror movie that I have seen.
And what
seen.
Did you think of it?
I thought it was real scary.
As a father of daughters.
Here's my thought.
Yeah. But it's not really like something where you're like, oh man, there's no holes in that lineup. I mean, there are several bad Exorcist films, many of which have been production disasters. And now they're like, we've committed ourselves. I mean, maybe they haven't. Maybe they're just like, it's worth it to us to have Believer going on Peacock and then be able to do Universal Halloween Horror Nights with Reagan from Exorcist jumping out at people. But like, it seems like a pretty high price tag for that.
Isn't it? Like, what do you, I mean, you see horror movies and think about them. So you're the person, I can't contractually have an opinion about this, but it does seem odd to me that The Exorcist.
Your contract with God.
You know, the contract I made with Spotify recently where they're like, you can't talk about this. The Exorcist is a classic 1970s film.
Mm-hmm.
It is also a genre film. And the fact that it is a genre film somehow puts it in a different category where there isn't enough respect on its name as a film that was one thing. Do you know what I mean? Like it just keeps... And I know sequels came pretty quickly, right? When did The Exorcist 2 come out? But we don't see...
Exorcist 2, The Heretic, came out in 1977.
How'd that do? I did not see that
not
because
great.
I did not feel like I had to. Our guy Billy Friedkin was not involved in
no,
that.
No, John
right?
Borman directed that one, and I believe he had a tough time with it.
Emphasis on Bohr, right? No?
No, my guy John Borman, he had some jams.
I'm just saying for that movie. This is what you're gonna get from me when you've led our conversation.
New York Post headline writer, Andy Grimmel.
It's all I could do when we talk about horror movies.
Emphasis on Bohr, am I right?
I got nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing on this topic whatsoever. But
no, I wanna I'm trying to get you to talk about
Poltergeist, that was one I liked.
No, it's not even about horror. It's about the idea of, like, for the majority almost now, especially of The Watch, but almost of The Watch and Hollywood Prospectus, we have been both engaged with and, like, entertained by, what if we had a cool new take on this franchise idea?
Where
there was a part of this movie that if you just do the sliding doors thing, we can make a whole other movie about this, or a whole other franchise about this. And it has been a minute now since I feel like anybody has felt particularly satisfied by any of this stuff. And now I think people are starting to vote with their wallets more significantly.
I totally agree.
Exorcist, there's a world in which the reviews for Exorcist Believer were dynamite. There are some things to like about it. Leslie Odom is quite good in it. But let's say it was just like finally recaptures the spirit of Friedkin's original masterpiece. If you're going to see one horror movie, make it this. Everybody goes out and sees it this weekend because it's almost Halloween. But I mean, from the second this thing moved off of the Friday the 13th date that it had because it was scared of Taylor Swift, like, it just kind of felt like there was something wrong with it, and it turns out that there was.
Well, a couple things. One, I'd like to apologize to John Borman, who's 90 years young, still mm-hmm. with us. He directed Taylor Panama. That was good.
And the Excalibur, which
Hope and
is
Glory.
One of my personal favorites.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Zardoz, is that one of your favorites too?
No.
Okay, just checking. I also think that, like, The Exorcist, again, it conjures up, that's a pun, right? Feelings of, like, fear, and you know, there's positive connections with the movie, but The Exorcist isn't Halloween. There isn't, the villain of The Exorcist is the devil, right?
It's a demon named Pazuzu, actually.
I just didn't want to say it. Bring him.
It's not Beetlejuice. You can say his name a couple of times.
Okay,
that's
but
not
let's
how
not,
he arrives.
Let's not push it.
Just don't accept any gifts from people who have recently visited archaeological sites.
I never do. I never do.
Hey, I was digging around in Sumeria, and I found this cool necklace for you.
I only, when people travel, I'm just like, no, please don't bring me anything back, but unless you go to a wet market. Like, I'm passionate about local cuisines. So anything from there would be great.
Yeah.
Just don't go to any archaeological digs. I'm just saying, it does not seem particularly repeatable, yet they keep going back to it. It is not a natural... and also, you said something like, do you have a cool new take on this? I'm not sure if that's what's happening. The other larger point here that I think is relevant as studios try to obfuscate what's going on right now and over the next few months is remembering that even separate and apart from the strike, we're always on a bit of a tape delay mm-hmm. in terms of the content that's hitting our screens, when it was conceived, when it was developed, when it was greenlit. And this is one of those interesting periods, I think, where we are getting content beamed into our theaters or day and dated or whatever onto our streaming services that is from another world.
Yeah.
Like from an era that has so definitively ended, and everyone's just sort of going to be shrugging and doing the best they can with it. I know I've already been harping on a movie we haven't seen, perhaps unfairly, but I think The Marvels is going to be an interesting moment when it is finally unveiled for critics and unveiled for audiences. I think your point about people voting with their wallets is really true. This is, I hope that this is not the same conversation we often, conversational cul-de-sac we often get into who is this for?
Mm-mm.
I think it's really more.
That.
No, I know. Yeah. I'm saying the opposite, which is.
It's for me.
Does anyone, but who wants this?
Well, that was my grand gesture about karaoke mm-hmm. was the disparity between, or the divide between people deciding what movies are getting made and the people who are actually like your possible target audience. And that maybe The Exorcist, for as special and important as it is to horror fans and to cinema history, it just may not be like that. Like, it may not have a very high Q score anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like
well,
it might not be something that people walk around being like, it's time for, I can't wait to really find out what Pazuzu has been doing for the last couple decades.
That's twice. You're done. John Borman made Point Blank. That's a great movie. I do not think it is a viable entertainment industry model to make people feel nostalgia. I just don't think that that's a viable model. I think you can get a certain ways down the road with that. I think that you can sometimes hit it once or twice. You can deliver it perfectly, like Top Gun Maverick, which I also think the success of that movie, you can't really separate out from when they finally chose to release it. That was brilliant timing and marketing, as it turns out. And it was a moment when everyone wanted that, wanted to go to the theater, wanted to feel a certain way. And the lag time between something feeling fresh and something feeling nostalgic is remarkably reduced now.
Yeah.
So Marvel projects, like even we're going to talk about Loki, which I'm not going to excoriate. I mean, I enjoy it for what it is. There are moments within Loki where the forward momentum screeches to a halt. So Tom Hiddleston and Owen Wilson can do Iron Man-ish banter.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, look, remember this? Remember this? This felt good. This is what we're doing. I still think in a world that is fueled by people going to the movie theater en masse to see the same six movies a year that make $1 billion, what are you buying with that ticket? I think that for a lot of people, they would say they want to see something exciting. They want to see something new. If you're not showing them that, what are we doing?
Yeah.
How is that model successful anymore?
That is the question. But I think part of the reason why we're where we are with that is because we are on Fast and the Furious 10. We are on
right, where our new
Indiana
franchises.
Jones 5 with a very old man at the center of it. We are all at the ends of a lot of runs.
I saw him at dinner the other night.
Harrison Ford?
Yeah.
Did he fly or
his jet was No, he did not.
Was it on the West Side?
It was on the West Side.
Because you got to watch out when you're on the West Side with Harrison Ford.
Like with his erratic driving and flying?
No, that's where he like crashed his plane into a golf course.
He was walking to the restroom and seemed in good spirits.
Were people bugging him?
No.
It's the LA way.
You mean people other than me?
No, like were people like, oh my God, fucking, I love frantic. Can you take a picture with me?
So were you there?
No,
I just mean, the other thing about Harrison Ford is that he is a small old man.
Yeah, you don't really think that. You know what I mean?
He looks great. He looks handsome. He looks well. He was ambulatory. He was fine. He doesn't look any older than he looked in many of the recent movies.
Yeah.
But he's not a huge guy.
It freaks you out when you sometimes see stuff like that, though. Like, I remember when I interviewed Robert Downey Jr., mm-hmm. obviously a huge fan of his acting. Mm-hmm. And like I sat down next to him and I was like, oh my God, this is like the biggest star in the world right now. Like, yeah. I'm freaking out. And then I looked down and he was basically wearing like Marty McFly shoes, like moon boots.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, all right. You're just like a weird guy from Santa Monica.
Did you neg his fat?
No, I didn't. But I really like it brought the temperature down. I was like, okay.
You can rap with this guy.
Yeah.
Just mano a mano. Yeah. That means hand.
He and
hand,
I are basically the same.
That's what you're saying. Didn't you interview him in a like a airplane hangar that was
no,
rented
it was
for the
in,
event?
It was in the basement of a hotel in Santa Monica, but it was we talked about
oh, yeah.
how he had his 50th birthday party mm-hmm. in an airplane hangar and Steely Dan played. He got Steely Dan to play his birthday.
Were you like, that's exactly what I would do with my 50th birthday party too if I had enough money to do it?
And that was a hint he didn't take when I was like, if you wanted to underwrite my 50th birthday party.
Or we could do a co.
Yeah, like you. Yeah, exactly.
Birthday party.
Exactly. That's but now weird. That I've made fun of his shoes, I doubt that'll come to pass.
Yeah, that's a shame. I'm sorry. I am.
We can talk about Loki.
We should talk about Loki. But I think this bigger question, like maybe this is a cross pod or maybe we just feed this topic to Sean and Amanda. But like what is the blockbuster movie slate for the next 2 or 3 years? Like, what's already been dated? And are they all blank six,
yeah.
blank nine? What is this going to do for anybody? And we're so far down the road of committing to it.
I think that this summer changed a lot of people's
yeah.
field of vision. Because it's like, you come out and you're like, we had $2 billion movies of original material by visionary directors making movies the way that they wanted to make them. And they didn't have to worry about whether or not it would set up Ken World or, you know, the 14 Barbie spinoffs or, you know.
I mean, I do think that the wrong lessons will be taken, of course, as they always are. I think that this has empowered Mattel to like double down on the Polly Pocket expanded universe, which I don't right. think is the takeaway for Barbie's success. I am curious, honestly, I don't know what anyone's thinking. I mean, other people than us have said this repeatedly, like Oppenheimer is the most insane movie or entertainment story of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's close to $1 billion. It's a 3-hour biopic. That's crazy. Is there any takeaway from that or is just, no one talking about it?
I just think that sometimes you get somebody where you're like, it's Nolan, you know?
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm.
You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
All right, let's talk about Loki.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who's got two thumbs and like this show? This guy.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Did you think you were coming in and we were going to go off the top rope on this show?
No.
Together?
No.
Big fans of Benson and Moorhead, the directors. So
I've
enjoyed their independent science fiction and horror films over the years. They had one called Endless. They had one called The Spring or Spring that's really good. And they did a little bit on Moon Knight and have obviously been brought into the fold. And it's like, fool me once, fool me a million times, like when Marvel hires filmmakers that I like. But I got to say, I really thought that they brought a verve to the direction of this. Not that Kate Herron's was lacking in that in any way. It charmed me so much that I didn't really worry about the fact that I have no idea what they were talking about in the show.
Now, to be clear, because I'm not familiar with their short films, have they worked on anything
Science.
Before?
They're features. Like, they're
I'm sorry.
Full on. Yeah,
but I've not seen their films. Yeah. Have they worked on, did they work on season one of Loki?
They did not. Kate Herron directed, I think, all of,
I remember that.
Of season one of Loki. But they did do a couple episodes of Moon Knight and are in the mix. You know, they're now Marvel guys, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least they go to Marvel and they can play in the sandbox. I thought they did a great job with this opening episode. And I thought this was an example of something where the MacGuffin is basically the plot now. Like, the things that you thought in the first season of Loki were like a little bit sort of fun flights of fancy that were the storytelling device to watch this guy deal with his like questions about his own identity and like what his true self was are now essentially all of the show in this first episode. So it's all about like the rules of time travel, the history of the TVA, who runs it, what pruning means, like what's a sort of humanitarian way to prune timelines, like all this stuff that came up, but it was a lot of puzzles, tests, challenges for our protagonist to accomplish so that he can get to his final goal, which is, I guess, finding Sophie, right? Like,
I that seems to be one of the goals.
Yeah. So what did you think of the first episode?
Well, it's interesting, and this will probably be part of our conversation this week. Like,
Sophia DiMartino is the
actress who plays Sylvie. I think this show has style. I think this show has real verve. I think it has I think it takes chances and has fun and has a really developed sense of itself. And I could say precisely none of those things about the last few years of Marvel. And that's not a small thing. To have the show return and have it look good. And to have it look not just good, but to have it look idiosyncratic and itself. To have these sort of smaller decisions that, you know, that don't matter in the larger story about what we're going to do about Kang, but casting people like as that three panel of judges, you cast the Scottish actress, Katie Dickey, you cast the English actress and disability rights activist, Liz Carr, and then you have the other guy just being asleep. That's fun.
Yeah.
These are the seemingly small board decisions that in my mind separate art from nonsense, frankly.
Yeah.
So I was thrilled to see that. I was thrilled to see that there is a beating heart still in this. And I think that you're right. I don't know these directors, but I think that there's a visual just panache.
Yeah, I thought that there was like elements of it. The whole Marvel thing being like, you can Trojan horse in all these different influences. And I thought like this kind of looked like the Hudsucker proxy. You know, I mean, it was
just because if nothing matters, and I don't mean that like in a nihilistic sense, but I mean that like, one character being like, my ability is to do purple lines this way, and I can do purple balls. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah, right.
So why not have real tape players and Walkmen and flashing blue buttons? Because it all doesn't matter. So at least have some fun with it. I really appreciated that. Even the Owen Wilson spacewalk in the weird face-distorting suit with rainbow clouds coming off of him. Yeah, let's do it. Sure. Why not? That is different than what we've seen before. the but that's coming for me is that it was inevitable that because this is an MCU project, that the transition from this is a project about a character in a circumstance in a story in season one or in the first movie, when it then becomes a vehicle for a larger story that connects to other things, there is just a slackening and a softening. And the amount of verbal nonsense said in the beginning of this episode was jaw-dropping. And the amount of just getting everyone really worked up about something that 5 minutes ago didn't seem to matter and I didn't understand it, and frankly, I still don't understand it at the end of it, was tiring. You know, one of the nice things about the first season was the ability to just live inside of it and to live in this world where there's this, you know, this very stylized headquarters for people who are doing a very specific thing that seems to matter to them. Loki shows up like the audience and it's just like, what's this about?
Yes.
Great. All of a sudden, we're now in uncharted territory where they're all saying, what's this about? And what it's about is the Kang Dynasty coming in 2026, but let's see what we can do on the way to get there. And it becomes just once again, a delivery system for mixed results.
It's a really good point. It's the difference between Dorothy first arriving in Oz and making like the continuing adventures of Dorothy in Oz. And it's added on top of it is the constant, almost manic, like, are you in the future or are you in the past stuff? Now, there is a screwball element of that, which I think works really well, especially when they did the Kiwi Kwan OB scene. And it was like, do you remember me? And it's like, oh yeah, this is, and he's like, it's OB. And he's like, that's what I call him, OB. That's my nickname for him. Like, there was really funny stuff in in the kind of, like you said, the old school Avengers bantering thing. It does bring the story to a halt. But when the story is so confusing for me, and honestly, like, it's been 2 years since Loki.
Yes.
Time travel is not the easiest thing to sort of wrap your head around because they're just fucking making it up anyway as they go along.
Yes.
And on top of that, you know, the first season of Loki ends with this Kang revelation that this is going to sort of probably be the new big bad of Marvel, that this multiversal kind of experience is the defining sort of storyline of the next phase of these movies and of these TV shows. It actually felt like they were dancing around something in this episode, and I don't know whether that's the Jonathan Majors part. You know, I don't know whether or not there's a version of this where he's in the first episode.
Well, but he is. I mean, they can't do anything but run towards it. I mean, his giant stone face is the central image of this episode and what Loki's running around looking for and running from. This is unprecedented, you know, in terms of the entire... The Marvel Cinematic Universe is not the Tampa Bay Rays. And not to minimize any of the accusations involved by making a sort of a facile comparison, but when a player on the Rays was credibly accused of things or got involved with the law, he was removed from the team. They scrubbed his locker. Jonathan Majors' situation is not the same. I want to be very careful with what I'm saying here. But Marvel is, you can feel the machine inching forward as slowly as it can, and they don't know what to do. They don't know what's going to, they have not made a decision. They do not, about recasting him, about keeping him. They have all the stuff in the can that is central to him. I mean, I keep thinking about that last image from the Ant-Man movie, which is just a stadium full of 1,000 Jonathan Majors. Mm-hmm. This is where we're at. And that does inform our viewing of it. And so, you do wonder if they did try to rejigger what the season was and what it felt like and whether did they push him to the end of this 6-episode season? Did they minimize him? Will they recast him within this show? We honestly don't know.
Aside from professional obligation, would you keep watching this?
It's tough because I do love the style. I like, we should shout out the production designer, Kazra Farahani, who designed the first season and is directing an episode this season.
Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead are directing 4 of the 6 episodes.
Yeah, they do 1 and then 4, 5, and 6. I love Tom Hiddleston and Owen Wilson. Would watch them do anything.
Rafael Casal is cool.
The casting, Eugene Cordero, I mean, they have a lot of fun with that too. I love Sofia DiMartino in the first season. The bump for me is things like Wunmi Mosaku, who's a great actor as well. All of a sudden, she has to do the kind of house cleaning labor of the MCU, which is turn to the camera and say things like, thousands of innocent lives will be lost if we prune the variants from that timeline.
Yeah, I don't understand why that's become like...
Okay. I don't... You know what, for me, the biggest example of that was? Like, there's this fun set piece in the beginning where the time-slipping Loki jumps off of a balcony and lands on a space car, just like he had watched The Fifth Element once, and then crashes the car into the room where Eugene Cordero is listening to his Walkman, and then the car falls.
And you hear people screaming.
And you hear a crash, and you hear Tom Hiddleston say, he'll be fine. And then you feel the internal note and the late period CG where then in the background out the window, someone drew in that car belching smoke flying again. Because clearly the intention was that person just died.
Yes.
And then they were like, no, we'll fix that in post.
Yeah.
That kind of like, we have to be good. We have to be aligned with the larger values of whatever our, you know, corporate project is. You can sort of feel that. Look, it is what it is. These are people trying to do good work. I mean, everyone's trying to do good work, but these are people who have made established a beachhead of something interesting inside of something that we no longer find to be all that interesting.
Do you, I don't actually know, and I swear to God, like I paid attention. I'm not really sure what the hell is going on.
No idea.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Like, so Kate Dickey and Rafael Casals characters are like, we have to have like a militaristic reaction to Kang.
Even though Kang was in charge of us?
Yeah, but they didn't know that, right? Because there's some mystery. There's like, oh, like...
Well, there were those three robots. There was the three Time
Lords.
But
then they knocked down the wall and Kang is the wall behind the wall, right?
Yes. Do you think that's smart to like build a mural to yourself, but then put a second mural in front of it? Like if you want to trick people, just don't build the mural to yourself. Like how strong is your ego? You know what I mean? Like everyone here is operating under the big lie.
I'm more of a add me to the mural guy.
Right.
You know?
Right.
You know, when it's like Elliot Smith and then it's just like me.
Being like, do you want to come to my 50th birthday party?
You know,
nice shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. The other thing I have to throw in here that I found a little... Look, we're going to keep watching the show, but it's a little...
That's what I was asking. Yes. We stopped watching Ahsoka. So I was just like, I mean, we can make decisions independent of one another. I'm going to keep watching...
Well, apparently we're making more and more. Happy birthday to Phoebe, by the way. yes, but... One of the reasons why I'm interested in this is that point of like, is there a ghost in the machine? Because as part of the press for this season, now like the actors are still not, they're not back. So they're not doing interviews. Michael Waldron was credited as the creator. He still is in the credits. He created this Loki for television. He wrote a lot of the first season during his time as like Marvel's guy. He did a big rewrite of Doctor Strange. He's involved with the upcoming Avengers movies. He is not involved in this season, at least as far as we know. We don't actually know who's involved with Mutt, but he is no longer the credited writer. Eric Martin, who worked on the first season, I think is getting a lot of the credit and sort of presumably as the head writer. The reason I keep saying head writer and I keep saying presumably is because the mighty Marvel method of making TV is very odd and is not in keeping with what a lot of people expect it to be. From the beginning, people have understood that Marvel never wanted to call anyone showrunners.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they've bent on that a little bit. But from what I have heard, even the shows that have showrunners, the showrunners or the head writers do not have final cut. Like, they are not in the edit. Maybe they're in post, but they are certainly not the last people to touch the show.
Right.
Like, all these things are crafted internally by Marvel. And it was a little, I don't know, gave me a little bit of heebie-jeebies when I saw some interviews. And again, the Writers Guild strike was ongoing, which may have affected this or may have affected Eric Martin's ability to do press for the show that he worked on. But there's interviews like on Collider and other places like that where Kevin Wright, who is the Marvel development executive. Now, Marvel famously has executives in the room.
Okay. Yes. Right.
But this is
like
the guy who's...
like the committee or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've heard people, you know...
In fact, I think this gets detailed in Joe's book.
And I'm curious to talk to her about this. So maybe we can table this broadly for until later in the week. We've talked to people. We had Malcolm Spellman come on. He was the showrunner of the Falcon and Winter Soldier show. He was saying that he liked having people from Marvel there because you could bounce ideas off of them. They had a deep well of information, blah, blah, blah. But in these articles, Kevin Wright is basically being like, what a journey we've had. We've had total freedom from Kevin Feige making the show. You know, Tom Hiddleston and I have really been showrunning this from the beginning and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, So that's how it is in their family.
What do you mean by that?
Basically, the implication is that the Marvel staffer, the Marvel executive, is running the show.
I see.
He referred to in an interview that he and Tom Hiddleston have been running it.
Gotcha.
That the final decision making and the vision comes from the executive.
Right.
Obviously, as a still slightly rabid member of the WGA, that rubs me the wrong way. But I also think that is their process, and I think it's interesting to see that as we go from a show that we are giving all this credit to for being.
You think Tom Hiddleston is like, here's how time travel works?
No, I think that Tom Hiddleston is like signing off on the decisions that Kevin Wright brings to him because he's the star and he is also an executive producer. I do not.
Yeah.
He's involved. He's doing. He wouldn't do it if he didn't want to do it. They don't make the show without him. But all I'm saying is. I have an eye on this, not just for professional industry stuff, but also because we have singled out Loki as one of the Marvel projects that has an idiosyncratic point of view, that it has a look, it has a style, it has a voice, and it's possible. We don't know Michael Waldron. We don't know what went on. I'd like to talk to Joanna about this. Did Michael Waldron build them that template and then leave? And then now the executives are like, steering it back towards the mothership.
I don't, because if you ask me, I'd be like, this shit is like Hotel California, man. Michael Waldron can't go anywhere because he needs Loki to connect to the next thing, to connect to the next thing, to connect to the next thing.
That's how you end up back with the quote that was much maligned from Gwyneth Paltrow being like, I didn't even know I was in that movie.
Yeah, right.
But that's actually a feature, not a bug, I feel like, for the way Marvel makes things, where they're like, everyone's writing on everything, everyone's touching everything else, everyone's shooting stuff that could be for this or that, because the project you're making is the MCU. It's not Loki season two.
Right.
On a certain level. These are not new ideas or observations. I'll just put down my marker.
I think
everyone's
coming. I cannot wait to talk to Joanna about this with you. Because this is new stuff. This is brand new material for me.
I liked Loki season one as a TV show. It feels already that the ceiling for my engagement with this is I will like it as a cog in the MCU.
Right.
Those are different. I'm not being negative. I'm just saying.
So we're talking ceilings.
Mm.
There is no ceiling on Ahsoka. The ceiling was removed, but not because it's high, but because it's so low, right?
For my opinions about Ahsoka,
you were like living in a little coffin. That's how the ceiling for how good Ahsoka could be was like very.
Oh, I was like, what's his name's Rob Brydon's little man in a tiny box.
Yes.
When it came to Ahsoka, well. I mean, I'm not going to relitigate it. I didn't watch the finale.
Okay,
I love force pushes.
Okay, so
seems good.
But you are interested in Loki, but like only really more as part of like what's the larger sort of storyline it's telling.
No, I am not interested. Let me stop you there. I am not interested in the Kang Dynasty.
Okay,
I have no interest in a larger storyline. I'm saying that it just seems like the pleasures of the show have been curtailed.
Gotcha.
As it is steered more towards servicing the larger, what's it called? The sacred timeline of the MCU.
That's right.
Right? Like, I just thought the first season was good. It was on my top 10 list.
Yeah.
Fun actors doing fun things. It was great.
All right. Let's talk about fucking Tenerife and timeshares.
Yeah. Let's go.
Another episode of The Gold, the penultimate episode of The Gold. Mm. I would say perhaps a bit of a award reel for my guy Hugh Bonneville.
For real.
For fucking Brian Boyce. For folks who, I mean, I assume that if you're listening to this part, you're like up on The Gold, but we'll spoil episode 5 from here on out. It's essentially a real like the walls are closing in on our criminals. Although when walls close in on Mickey McAvoy, he just hires a helicopter to take him out of prison. A couple things I really loved in this episode. Obviously, Bonneville really, really enjoyed Detective Stallings dueling with Mickey McAvoy's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Really, really had fun with that. Mickey McAvoy's girlfriend is on one.
She's a real one.
She's a firecracker. Naming her dogs after the Brinksmat mm-hmm. crime. And also just like her scene with Donnie the cabbie.
Mm-hmm.
And just every moment with her. You know,
she's is she in the pantheon for you?
No, the pantheon of
just like is she like
of British women who will break you out of prison
that you would throw away your life for? Like, is she just like no?
Yeah, she's up there with like Imelda Staunton. You know,
that's an actress. is she on your pantheon? Is she drawn into the mural?
Sophia Laporta, who plays Kathleen Meacock.
Okay.
That's the name of
we
the character.
We sure are. We're talking about her.
Yeah.
I just didn't know if you're, she's drawn into the mural, too, next to you and Elliot Smith.
Oh, me, Elliot Smith, right.
And Mickey McAvoy's and Loki, yeah. Hold It Down, Ride or Die. Okay.
What did you think of the episode?
I completely agreed with the first thing you said, was that this was the BAFTA reel. There's a thing that can happen like a couple episodes in where you're like, look, we know the ride we bought the ticket for. And so the entire scene, the whole construct of like Hugh Bonneville's character is like, I will go to Switzerland and get the Swiss to do something that they are just like, literally, what's the one thing we all
what's
know about Swiss people?
What's the point of Switzerland? It's chocolate, watches, and keeping fucking secrets.
Yeah, and you will not know whose money this is. That's basically what they do there, yeah. And they're very good
at
it.
And he's just like, well, if you sit in this room, but we also might accidentally mention the two main characters.
But also, I just love it can go one of two ways. If you disagree with this on principle, you're going to find that some of the aspects of this episode were a little bit showboaty and a little bit like, you know, but
I think that we've now reached
it, but we're into it. And so him showing up and just having a scene where they like choke down cold glasses of chilled fucking red and talk about what war means to them in order to extract a feeling of empathy and commonality,
yeah,
to get them to betray their national point of pride. Look, I love it.
Yeah.
I thought it was a sick scene.
Do you think that too many people in this show have reached total and complete self-awareness? Like,
yes.
Where every single character is like, here's exactly how I see myself within these rungs of society.
Yes.
Here's how I understand what English society does to people like me. Here's why I did what I did because I'm English and because I'm trying to do this.
Yes, they are characters and they are cogs.
Yeah.
There's not a single person in the show who isn't like, I am a person, but what I really am is an exemplar of what it means to be English.
Yeah.
And I am grist for the
mill. But
even
there's a scene where Cooper goes home to his wife and she's like, I never understood what you meant about the boy, like the man who you used to be, and now I see you, and the boy you were, and now I see it in you. And it was like, that is very perceptive.
But also, how about when there's like, where are you from? And he's like, fear.
Yes.
I'm from fear. That's, it's like, right. Actually, you're from a council estate in South London. You go there in the episode. And unless it's called like, unless that's the name of that place. No, the relationship this show has to metaphor is very interesting.
Yeah.
But it is about something more than its plot. And the one thing that I think is an absolute undeniable plus that was illustrated by this episode is, again, we don't know the historical record. I plan to read a great deal about it on Wikipedia pages beginning next week. But I don't want to be spoiled. I want to know. It seems as if the historical shape of this case is not that thrilling after a certain point.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
And the show also seems to, again, we don't know. It does seem to have an interest in at least keeping within the realm of recorded fact and possibility, not straying too far outside the lines. Again, could be wrong, but that's what it seems like. And so what do you do to kind of zhuzh out
the
meal?
You have people write essays about being English.
And you put sauce and mustard on everything.
Yes.
And you make a meal out of it. And I am not mad about that. I think it has made for some riveting, entertaining television. It's given some great, it allows you to have great acting performances. It's made really compelling characters out of Jennings and Brightwell, the cops who've been following from the fly-in squad the whole time. But this was the episode, and maybe this leads into something you want to talk about, where for the first time I was like, oh, it's not going to be that shocking. It's interesting, but it's not going to be that surprising anymore. And is this...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it ends. And, you know, you think about, say, the way cases on The Wire sort of resolved themselves in ways of not resolving themselves, but in the lack of resolution said something much more profound about society.
Yes.
And The Wire also dabbled with people having a lot of self-awareness and a lot of...
The Wire is about the American city.
Understanding of the way that they fit in with the tapestry of the city, like what thread they were. I think you're right. I don't know that this case is actually like a shoot 'em up, you know, so it's probably a lot of people looking for A24 notes. And so to fill it out, you get some scenes that are...
That, by the way, so are all the indie filmmakers in America.
That's right.
They're just looking for those A24 notes.
You know, is this the invention of timeshares? Like, I don't even know what we're watching with in Tenerife.
Also, are we ever going back there? I don't think so.
I mean...
But the Wire point, the Wire comparison becomes more and more interesting to me because... And let's say this again. We are not comparing the 6-episode British miniseries to one of the undisputed all-time greatest television series. But what is interesting to me is the ability that this show has demonstrated in such a short amount of time to create a depth of character and a depth of society that has insight into a larger cultural, national concern. Like this, we're saying, like this show is just unabashedly about England and being England and the project of
being
English.
At a very crucial point. And like, yes. They'll just be like, look at Margaret Thatcher talking to Ronald Reagan about missile defense systems.
And yet, it is limited its scope to 6 episodes about one crime that does reach from high to low, and it's a well-chosen crime and it's well-adapted. It does make me think that Neil Forsythe, with this cast, and even literally some of these characters, could have made a legendary 6-season show about policing or society in Thatcher's England, and we would be raving about it. In the same way that The Wire built this tapestry of characters and brought its point of view and, you know, boots on the ground in Baltimore for all those years about made-up cases so that it could be about a city. Now, The Wire was based on things that had actually happened, you know, especially during David Simon's time covering the police force there, but it was fictional and ongoing. This is historical and limited. And, you know, you get different results from that.
I just really want to say that when she's like, Mickey's having a really hard time and the cab driver's like, that's the point of prison, isn't it? That's kind of the point. All right. Well, I mean, we're obviously going to be talking about the last episode. I don't really have like a...
Did you... Jennings, your other ride or die, Nikki Jennings, played by Charlotte Spencer, when she's just like, what's the guy's name? The art dealer? Who just had one bad day?
The guy
in Liechtenstein.
Went to Liechtenstein. Yeah.
What's the guy's name? Keith or something?
Yeah.
She's like, you've ruined your life, Keith. That's tough talk.
Yeah.
That is tough talk.
She's a
from
straight shooter, man. She does not speak in metaphor.
Yeah. Do you think? I mean, on some level, I understand why. You know, you just can't stay. And a lot of the characters are like you, in that you just can't stay away from England. despite rising viral loads and everything, like you just kept going back. Is there another version of the show where they just don't go back?
Well, who doesn't go back?
Well, I mean, everyone goes back in this episode.
Because the
goes
one
back.
Detective in Tenerife,
he was on it,
hunted down Palmer pretty easily at his timeshare.
Well, he was on Front Street.
What's up with Palmer? Is like, you get 500 quid for every timeshare you sell, but no salary.
Did you see that part? Yes.
I mean, it was part of the show.
That's the podcast model. Isn't it?
You're doing a lot of contract talk today. You trying to say something?
I'm always negotiating.
I think you have a pretty cushy gig. You know, you come in with your boy. I got nothing but anecdotes for you.
It's true. And prep. You also have a lot of prep.
Did you think I prepared well today?
Yeah, you were at the karaoke bars till God knows how long this weekend, and you're still...
I was
still
out until 1 a.m.
1 a.m.?
Yeah.
What? That's when Kaya's sitting down to dinner.
A lot of beers. But yeah.
How'd that treat you?
They actually, when you stretch them out over that period of time and you're rocking out, it's fine.
Do you think this is a sign of my Anglo, my love of England?
Mm.
Or like just... low-key alcoholism, that when there's the police...
You're low-key alcoholism?
Low-key, I'm like an alcoholic, but for low-key. that when they have the police sting in the pub...
In the gold.
In this episode last night.
Yeah.
I was just like, I wish I was there this afternoon, just pulling a pint.
No, I think you and I both crave...
Big mugs.
The sense of warmth that comes with a local... And we don't have that right now.
How do you...
At least shared between the two of us.
How do you feel about that? The Freemason cop?
I don't understand Freemasonry, and I think that the show has kind of fumbled the bag with that.
Because it was implied in the beginning that was like...
I think
important.
the Masons are the exorcist of this show, where it's like you're assuming people like know way too much about Masons.
Or are Freemasons the Jonathan Majors of the show, and American Freemasons edited that whole storyline out? Do you think that's possible?
Do you know
is this
anything
podcast
about Freemasons?
Even gonna be, There's a handshake.
Yeah. But like
the rest of my knowledge of them is informed entirely by the 30-year-old episode of The Simpsons where Homer joins the Stonecutters and they sing songs and there's an alien.
I always forget that you have like a pretty comprehensive Simpsons.
You know, I don't. I thank you for asking about that. But as
it wasn't really a question.
But how much time do we have left, Gaia? Just that
Contractually.
No, I think everyone knows that my preparation for the show involves watching the 1 to 1.5 things you've asked me to watch, plus anything that my children are interested in.
Are they into The Simpsons?
They're super into Simpsons, so we've been rewatching.
Has your older daughter started saying, don't have a cow, man?
No, that's first season shit.
Okay.
No, we went right into the good ones, the classic era.
But she skipped all the catchphrases.
Yeah, well, I think that even the ubiquity of like eat my shorts and do you think that they have like Calvin pissing on stuff stickers on their lunchboxes? Are you like you're asking? This sounds, you know, you're talking like a real Exorcist fan here. You know, like, are your children me? Do your kids like Ren and Stimpy t-shirts?
I never liked Ren and Stimpy.
You didn't?
Well, I just never had Ren and Stimpy clothes.
Oh, because you had travel baseball. You were playing sports.
I'm detecting a little bit of hostility.
No, that's often your answer.
Yeah,
I'm like,
I also just feel like Ren and Stimpy, like I was just like too old for it. Weren't you too old for Ren and Stimpy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Goes home, burns bullets.
Scrubs photo books. Crying the whole time. I just throw it all in my backyard smelter. Hopefully the cops never find this.
All right. I think we can wrap up.
I think we probably should.
Thanks to Kaya for producing us today. She seems pretty happy about it.
Kaya's always happy.
And we'll be back on Thursday with Joanna Robinson to have a broader conversation about the MCU.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have a little other stuff in that episode, you know, just to spice it up.
There might be other shows we're going to watch, right?
I mean, now that I've got you hooked on the morning show, don't you have to see how January 6th works out?
For everyone. In a way, we're all living that cliffhanger.
Thanks for listening to the Watch Podcast. We'll talk to you on Thursday.